I hadn't been born into the circus profession. I was merely an outsider or josser. But in 1847, at the age of just 16, I'd resolved to become a clown in my grandfather's circus. I had no obvious skill to offer, so as an untried boy I was given any odd job: grooming, cleaning, taking checks, collecting money at the door and counting tickets. In my view, this was all woman's work. But at least I was in the family business. At that time, it was still just a small setup with 6 horses, 3 riders, a clown and a strongman. We would travel the length and breadth of the country, sometimes setting up at fairs, sometimes in wooden fit-ups, sometimes even supporting theatre companies in shows like Cinderella or The Battle of Waterloo. We had to reach new audiences every day and take their pennies for seeing the shows, which meant we had to move to a different town on an almost daily basis and draw new crowds each night. The success of drumming up a circus crowd relies on a spectacular parade into the town to announce our arrival, for which everyone is pressed into service in their gayest character dresses, all preceded by the band and any beasts in the caravan. Once over, we would look for lodgings and a snack before going back to the tent, which might be a mile or more from the town, then dinner, followed by the performance until 10. After the night's work, I'd have to go round the various stables and see the horses were fed, feet cleaned and bedded. Then I would go tired and weary to bed, before back in the tent first thing to take money. We were always anxious to present shows related to the location we were working, and regularly offered dramatic pieces as a climax to the show. In Newark, there was an old public house called the King's Head, at the back of which was a small window from which it was said Dick Turpin escaped just as his pursuers entered the front door. He had slipped through the window, pistol in hand, straight onto the back of his horse Black Bess, crying, "Pursue me, you bloodhounds, in rear and van! My foot's in the stirrup now, catch me who can!" Unsurprisingly, we were keen to play Dick Turpin there. Now, as everyone knows, the climax of the Turpin story is his spectacular ride from London to York on his mare, Black Bess, at the end of which his poor, devoted Bess goes lame, then dies. We obviously needed a black horse which could feign both lameness and death to play the part of Black Bess, but we had no such horse in our stable, apart from ones which were cream or spotted. However, during our stay in Newark, there was a horse fair where Uncle Charles and Grandfather purchased an Irish black colt of 16 hands. A fine specimen, but too frisky to do much with. Uncle did his best at breaking her to play the part. She would jump the turnpike gate, go lame on cue, but at the last, Bess would not die, and neither carrots nor stick would make her. Then the governor had an idea. My Uncle Charles Hengler was a fine horseman, but could also paint and make properties. So he sent me off to a draper to buy unbleached calico, and Mrs. Hall, the wardrobe keeper, was instructed to arm herself with thread and needles and to make unlimited black lamp paint. The governor sketched out the profile of a life-size horse on a double cloth, which Mrs. Hall stitched and then stuffed with straw. A tail was found and cut from one of the horses in the stable, painted in like fashion, then sewn on, and there was our dead Black Bess. A rehearsal was immediately called. Then after tea, the curtain went up to a good first house. The horse leapt the gate, and the pair made their desperate escape at the cost of poor Black Bess's utter exhaustion. In the final scene, Uncle Charles as Turpin addressed his dying mare in an agony of grief.
"The best mare that man ever owned is dead, and I have killed her."
He raised her head and kissed her lips, but alas, no response.
She was no more, and brave Dick collapsed upon her calico-covered, straw-filled,
lamp-painted corpse, and down came the curtain to cheer after cheer. No one was ever the wiser. Oh, bless me. I became dismayed with what I regarded as my menial tasks backstage for the Henglers. So I resolved to learn the tricks of what is known in the trade as posturing, a style of performance whereby I would force my body to contort into extraordinary and unlikely positions. I was a lanky youth with big eyes, red nose, and lantern jaws. It provided a contrast to the sculpted athletic bodies of the true-born athletes in our troop, and therefore well suited to posturing. But how should I begin? When I inquired, all I was told was to practice. I confided to an equestrian rider friend about my plan, and all he said was, "You're much too old for it. Your bones are set." Nevertheless, I commenced with performing the splits, and from the time I awoke to the time I went to bed, I trained my muscles. At all times and in all places, home, theatre, tent, pub, even church. Soon I was able to do a few simple posturing tricks, which I could practice easily enough in my bedroom. But I wanted to do a forespring, which means throwing yourself on your hands and turning over onto your feet. And for this, I needed to rehearse in the ring, with the risk of discovery. And sure enough, the governor caught me practicing and gave me a good slanging, saying, "You're too old and a josser into the bargain." Well, business was bad, working conditions freezing. And since the governor disliked my plan so much, I determined to see if I could make my way independently as a posture master. So, with half a crown in my pocket, I headed for London to seek my fortune. Once there, I made towards Astley's, thinking I might hear of a situation for me. Astley's was, and remains, the first, the finest, and most prestigious circus space in the land. All around it were many smaller penny cirques, low dives where acts could perform their turns or tricks in a hall, converted barn, or skittle alley. At one of these, I met up with an old equestrian from Henglers called Dick Moffat, who offered me a position as a posturer. In my lodgings at night, after the household had gone to bed, I would undress and have a good practice at my posturing. Late one night, after I'd been practicing hopping the frog on the eve of my very first public performance, I was sitting on a chair with my legs behind my back, but somehow managed to topple over onto the fender, which made a great clatter. I was concerned that I had awakened the whole house and listened in fear. But all was silent, so I went at it again. I was sitting back in the chair, preparing to hop to the ground on my hands, when I thought I heard something. I looked up, and through the skylight saw three ladies looking down at me, trying to stifle their giggles. Down I toppled, with the result that they gave full vent to their smothered laughs. I instantly extinguished the gaslight and listened to their peals of laughter in humiliation and despair, whilst trussed like a chicken in the darkness. The next day came, and I was ready to perform as a posturer. I was announced by Fuller the clown.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I have the honour to introduce for your favour His Grace, the Duke of Limbs."
As I appeared, the crowd greeted my entrance with a roar of rough laughter and abuse as they saw for the first time my scrawny skeletal form. But my posturing act was a success, and I left the ring with pride. Over the following weeks, I managed to earn a living by touring round the miscellaneous halls and penny gaffs of London and offering my tricks and turns for 6 or 7 hours a day. Whew, it was a battering and brutish form of work. Nevertheless, It taught me my trade. And once I had a few shillings in my pocket, I decided to walk to Rugby, where I knew of a circus company who might engage me. But they didn't. So then I walked to Birmingham. But it didn't work out there either. I had no situation and no one knew me. I was very hard up by now, hungry and with nowhere to sleep. So I started for Coventry. That was a miserable day, and awful for travelling. Snow was thick upon the ground, and the journey took me until it was dark. I went straight to the Red Lion, where I knew the landlord to be a friend of my uncle's, and he directed me to a nearby publican called Judd, who had a concert room. As luck would have it, he needed someone that evening on account of a disappointment, so I was engaged as a tryout that same night. I stood in the wings, waiting for my turn, trembling with fear and hunger. The house was crowded. My first trick was to hop very high, holding my left knee in front of my face, then hop over it. I got a cold reception, and it went without even a hand. Next, I stood on one stiff and straight leg directly under an object suspended a few inches above my head and then kicked the object with the other leg. Everyone frowned. Finally, I sat down, hands in pockets, raising my leg perpendicularly to my side. Then I knocked off my hat and scratched my head with my foot. I got around! And I was engaged for a short run at Judd's concert room, which was welcome for a freezing week or so. I happened to be painting a cardboard sign for the show when I overheard someone inquiring after me. A colleague came over and said, "There's a gentleman wants you." "Show him in," I said loudly, as if it was a common occurrence. "No," said the voice outside. "You come here." It was Uncle Charles Hengler who had found me. "Well, Jim, have you had enough of vagabondizing yet?" There was no need for a reply, and he agreed to take me back on at Hengler's, so long as I submitted to some new clothes, a hat, and a haircut. I returned to Hengler's circus on a wage of 15 shillings a week, and my duties were to count the checks, attend the box office, and see the horses were cleaned out and comfortable for the night. In other words, I was back to where I started as a general dog's body. But I still wanted to perform as a clown.